as the sounds of Maybe Tomorrow bring us back, welcome to hour two of the program. I'm going to try really hard not to make this segment just about a bunch of inside jokes about the old MVSW podcast, but I'll introduce Greg Wyshynski this way. Here to drunkenly yell at me about Rick Nash, my good friend from ESPN, Greg Wyshynski. How you doing, Wish?
Well. He gets a national radio show and needs to call me up for the ratings boost. This is like giving away Roman Reigns and Brock Lesnar on regular television instead of pay-per-view.
This is old school hot shot, the last quarter of Raw. This is get the TV segment. Uh-oh, Nitro's nipping at our heels. Got a hot shot of TV segment. Wait a minute, Vince. We can put this on a pay-per-view. You don't understand. The number on Tuesday morning means more to my ego than a number on a Sunday night. So,
That's exactly right. This is a shameless attempt to juice the demo. But I am so proud of you for being the old national radio boy up there now and all the stuff that's happening with you on Hockey Night. It's lovely.
Well, listen, the respect is mutual, Mr. ESPN. It's not selling out, by the way. It's buying in. That's what I always said about my career. When I went from like little wrestling hipster dude to one of the majors, whether it's CBC or now it's Rogers Sportsnet. Let's actually, again, like we'll try to reduce the random penguin references, although I got one from Jay Caulfield a couple of seconds ago. We'll try to keep those to a minimum. I want to talk about the Caps game yesterday. And Ryan Reeves and Tom Wilson were on the ice for 9 seconds together yesterday. Like, this wasn't even, remember the old Marty McSorley, Nick Fatiu shadow box match, as everyone built that one up and thought that was going to be the clash of the heavyweights. Even David Letterman showed it, like the fight that was scheduled to happen, but never happened. Remember I asked Marty about it once and he's like, I think we were both afraid of what the other would do to us. It wasn't even that. It was the opposite. I don't know what the opposite and equal equivalent to a cork coming out of a champagne bottle would be, but that was that last night. If you came for Reeves versus Wilson, what did you expect last night to be about? Because it wasn't that.
What? Yeah, it was like a surprise party, but the door never opens. Like, it was just, you know, there was an anticipation, I think, from everybody around the rink last night that at the very least there was going to be some sort of let the steam out kind of fight in the first period involving one of the principals so that then we could all move on with life. And, you know, one of the only things I could figure last night was that you had Gary Bettman in the building. You had Bill Daly in the building. You had George Parros in the building. Bill Daly told me before the game that it had been communicated, quote, to various levels of both organizations that the league was going to be on watch for anything happening in that game. And we've seen it in the past where, like, there's been a big line brawl, and then the next time the teams meet, they get the stern talking to before the game about, you know, not having shenanigans. So maybe that happened last night, because otherwise, you know, this whole thing was built up. I mean, let's face it. I mean, Tom Wilson became the de facto general manager of the New York Rangers during the offseason for this very moment. And none of the people that they brought on made any impact in the game last night with their fists.
You see, you know what I was thinking the whole time, Wish? The whole time I was thinking, if it's not going to happen off the opening draw and they just get it over with, one thing I kept coming back to was something that that Brad May told me. This is years ago. I remember I asked him about the legendary fight with the late Derek Bougard. And he said, listen, Bougard played it perfectly because I wanted to do it right away. Because, you know, this is after, you know, Mayday concussed Kim Janssen in that Anaheim, Minnesota series. And everyone knew that it was going to happen. Like, Bougard, like, here it comes. And Brian Burke told me, he went to Brad and said, listen, you don't need to do this. And Brad's like, no, I need to do this. And he was being, you know, tortured all week long, just thinking about it, couldn't sleep. His wife, I think it was a Sunday game, and he said that his wife kept playing Sunday Bloody Sunday every time he'd like go have breakfast, like in the kitchen, like just mental torture, Wish. And my whole time, I was just wondering, like, and when they were on the ice, Mayday was like, okay, let's just get this over with. And Derek just kept saying, no, we're not going to do this now. And as the period went on, no, we're not going to do this. And we'd line up and Brad like, let's do this. And no, we're not going to. And it waited until the third period to finally get it over with, as everyone knew it was coming. I was in the back of my mind thinking that, is this Ryan Reeves reprising that role? But at some point in the game, it became really obvious this just wasn't going to happen. and maybe you're going to have to wait till these two teams are at MSG, or maybe this doesn't happen at all. Do you have a feeling on whether the nerves are still close to the skin, the wounds are still open, or is the Ranger Capitals thing just done?
It could be, or like you said, it could be they step into the ring at MSG and all of a sudden it becomes fight night again. I find it hard to believe that there won't be another chapter of this. Now, granted, it's not going to be because Tom Wilson wants to write another chapter. I talked to him yesterday at practice, and he's kind of stole it as like, I don't want to have to do this. I want to be a different player this year. I want to focus on goal scoring. I want to focus on helping my team. I don't want to focus on having to, you know, relitigate the past with the New York Rangers. But at the same time, I think he told this to you at some point, maybe on like ice servicing or whatever, but like the Ryan Reeves, I'm the solution to your Tom Wilson problem thing.
Yes.
Like, he hates Tom Wilson, like legitimately hates the man. And I have to wonder, you know, whether or not, if given the opportunity, he'll take his shot the next time he gets it. But yeah, like you said, off the hop, it's kind of hard to take advantage of the opportunity if you don't have the opportunity, when you're not sharing the same ice with the guy for almost the entirety of the game.
You know where that line comes from? That I'm the solution to your Tom Wilson problem? That came from a conversation before Reeves went to Vegas. That was a conversation with the Rangers. And ultimately, he ends up back with the Rangers. But that was part of, like, I love it. Like, I think Ryan Reeves is one of the great personalities. That was part of his sales pitch to the Rangers.
Yeah.
Like, look, you have a problem, I'm the solution. I'm the exterminator. So, like, there was a go-around before with Ryan Reeves and the Rangers before he ultimately went to Vegas. I'll tell you, man, there's a couple of players stole the show for me. And like I was saying to Friedman off the top, if I look back on last night, and if you said, all right, Merrick, you can grab one image from all the games last night, the one image that I grab is TJ Oshie grabbing Hendrix Lapierre, like dropping his gloves and stick to grab Hendrix Lapierre, to pull him up off the ice, to push him up against the glass to celebrate his goal. I don't know how much you've interacted with Hendrix Lapierre, but that guy is one of the young bright spots in the game, period. I don't know if he sticks with the Caps all year long. I don't know if he sticks past game night. I don't know if he's going back to junior. I don't know what the future is this year for Hendrix Lapierre, but somewhere down the road, that guy is going to be a darling everywhere in this league. What did you make of Oshie last night?
Well, here's what I made of it. I think we're all looking for future skills competitions at the All-Star game. And deadlifting your rookie teammate off the ice
to gorilla press him in a celly.
You consider, yeah, I think the clean and jerk of a young rookie teammate off the ice is something that could definitely spice up the competition. It was awesome, and again, like the great thing about having an enthusiastic young player like Lapierre on your team, and having him have that moment, and of course he did the solo skate before the game and the whole thing. He's got his family and the whole thing. Is just to see the reaction from like the grizzled vets, and I'm in the room last night watching Oshie and Lapierre do their post game, and like I'm looking at Oshie's face, and like I remember when he was the fresh faced kid with the Blues, you know, and he was the guy that you'd talk to like David Backes and others, and they would get really enthusiastic about the exploits of young TJ Oshie, and now I'm looking at him, and he's got the little weathered look to him now, and he's sitting next to a kid who looks like he's like, you know, on a CW drama. And it's just amazing to see the childlike enthusiasm of a player like Oshie come out in that moment where, I mean, he threw his gloves in the air like they just won the cup when the kid scored the goal. And like, it's a lovely thing to see. And it's those moments when you realize that the insertion of a young player into the lineup can sometimes reinvigorate a team in ways that you don't anticipate. And I'm one of the people, and I have my predictions out on ESPN.com today as far as like what the standings look like. I'm one of the people that counted the Capitals out. And now, of course, I feel like a schmuck because they looked pretty good last night. But it's those types of moments and those types of players that can just kind of give your team a shot of adrenaline when things may have atrophied a little bit. And that was the feeling last night watching that kid play.
Glenn Sather used to always say when he ran the Oilers, like this is the heyday of Glenn Sather and obviously the Oilers winning Stanley Cups. His rule was every year, regardless of whether you don't make the playoffs or whether you win the Stanley Cup, change it 10 to 15%. Just for that like what you're talking about, just to keep everything fresh so things don't get stale, and you don't have guys like you and me saying, oh, the Capitals are going to age out and that's it, it's all coming to a crescendo here and it's the end of the symphony, now everyone go home, thank you very much. He always said, like, change it 10 to 15%. And I think that's an interesting point when you look at the kids that are coming in, and some you might cynically look at and say, listen, out of financial necessity, you need guys on their entry-level deal. But kids now step in and contribute right away. I guess this is a well-told story. But at the other end of that spectrum is Alexander Ovechkin. And to me, the Ovechkin phenomenon is interesting, and we've both been there to document and watch all of it, Wish. And when he came in, he was the lovable, goofy guy that could barely spit out the name Jerome Iginla when he was asked who his favorite player was, right? And everyone loved it. And then there's the Coyotes goal, like flipping on his back, and we've all seen it before. Paul Maris still has nightmares about that goal, I'm sure. And then somewhere along the way, I don't know what it was. I've sort of always drawn it at the hot stick celebration. People seem to turn on Ovechkin. Like, there was that, he went from babyface to villain, and now in the back nine of the career, Alexander Ovechkin, again, to borrow a wrestling phrase, is back to being a babyface, and he's back to being lovable Ovechkin. When you look at his career and look at it as a story arc, it's really been fascinating. I don't know where or why it changed. But for the longest time, there was, A, you can't win with Ovechkin, bad teammate. You know, he's got that Yager-esque, you know, remember they used to talk about Yager in Washington? Oh, he won't even do line rushes with his team. Like, bad teammate, get him out. Like, somewhere along the way, he became, like, the monster. You know, all the villagers around the castle, send out the monster, we have the torches. What changed with Ovechkin? Like, when you look at his story, it's kind of gone up and down and now back up again. How do you look at Ovechkin's career so far?
I think it was more about the trajectory of the Capitals than it was about Ovechkin. Because if you track the public sentiment about Ovechkin through the years, it kind of matches up with the public sentiment about the Capitals. And the Capitals, for those who maybe don't remember, are kind of like where the Leafs are now, where, and I know I'm really tempting fate bringing up the Leafs on the national Canadian broadcast.
Do it.
I understand the dynamics. Like, there's a certain amount of joy that people take in seeing the foibles of the Leafs and the failures of the Leafs. And this may always happen in perpetuity, but I think specific to the Capitals was there was a time, much like now with the Leafs, that we all loved to look at the Capitals and their failures and see them lose to the Penguins with regularity and see the new and exciting ways that they would fail to reach their potential in the playoffs. But then it got to a certain point where we're just like, you know what? Enough. You know, we could take our foot off their throats for a second, and we could look down and say to ourselves, we would really like to see this team win, and we would like to see Ovechkin win. I think there was a certain point in Ovechkin's career when we all realized that this guy is going to be one of the greatest goal scorers of all time, if not the greatest, if you want to adjust for error.
No, like Wish, and the greatest. I'm on team greatest.
Me too. I mean, based on the quality of goaltending, based on the defensive systems, everything else. And so I think we all came to the conclusion that if that's going to be the case, none of us wanted to have to put ourselves through the conversations about his legacy if he didn't win. If he went into the Hall of Fame having surpassed Gretzky, and then didn't win a cup, and to have those conversations with the people to detract him because he didn't do what Sid did, or he didn't do what, you know, Kane did, or anybody from his era or generation. And I think we all kind of silently came to the conclusion that life would be a lot easier if Ovechkin won, and if the Capitals won with him. And I think that was the change. You're right on the trajectory. Like, there was a time in which we took great joy in seeing a miserable Alex Ovechkin after the postseason. And then we all kind of came together almost, you know, telekinetically and said, you know what? Enough of this. We want to see him succeed and happy.
See, I got room for everybody under the tent here. And I want to go at it this way. One, lovable Ovechkin is fun. Like that Mass Mutual commercial with Backstrom is hilarious. It's fantastic. Like, I tweeted out the equivalent that I can think of. It's an old Andy McDonald, Brian Glenny commercial from like 78 for Swanson TV dinners, where Glenny like rips off, you know, the door from the fridge to get one. Like, it's the equivalent of those two guys, wow. But in today's era.
This is amazing. You made a reference to something from the 1970s.
I know. Listen, the more things change, the more they stay the same. As we say in French, plus ça change, plus ça reste la même. I know. It's MBSW all over again. I'm going to make a really dated, straining reference. And you're going to go like, do you have a calendar? Does your watch just read out the years, Merrick? Like, do you have like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 on your watch? But, you know, we're in an era now where, you know, personality is at a premium. And I'm going to get to a Tint Advisors question here in a second. I swear it's going to be strained, but I'm going to get there. We're in an era right now where it's, and this is like only the last couple of seasons in the NHL, where players are actually being encouraged now more so than ever, not just by fans, but by the league itself, to show their personality, to do more things that other people can relate to. And I remember talking to Ovechkin, you can see this on YouTube, it's out there, a couple of years ago at the NHL Players Tour in Chicago. And I asked him if he's still pissed off the NHL wouldn't let him wear his tinted visor. Right? The RoboCop visor, as I called it. I loved mm-hmm. that visor. It was great. And he said, yeah, even to this day, I think it's BS. And I hate it. I wonder if that came out now. This is more of a question for the NHL than Ovechkin himself. If that visor came out now, do you think they'd let it? Do you think they'd allow it in the NHL? We've seen yellow visors and things like that. But the tinted one had a real cool robot look to it. Do you think the NHL would allow it today?
No. They won't, because I still think that they're, even though we're slapping ads on jerseys next season, like, there are certain things about the uniform that's sacrosanct, and as much as we are allowing players more personality and encouraging it, and, you know, using new television deals to do big personality features on players so new fans can get to know them, there's still a certain amount of conservative streak when it comes to personality on the ice. Whether it is the actions of players that are demeaned by their teams, he shouldn't have celebrated like that. Whether it's the fact that goaltenders can put whatever they want on their masks, but God forbid they put anything on their pads that's really outlandish, or that the players get a chance to put things on their helmets that's outlandish. I feel the Ovechkin personality thing is always very interesting to me because of the fact that he's forever tied to Crosby. And as we talked about on the podcast for years, like, he was the Stones to Crosby's Beatles, and it was, you know, you were in one camp or the other, and the juxtaposition was glorious. And I do feel like Ovechkin may have been ahead of the curve of where we are as far as player personalities go, but he is still, and every young player is in the same boat. They're still in this league where we want a certain amount of personality. We want a certain amount of counterculturalism, but we don't necessarily want to see it manifest in places where, the traditional tropes of hockey keep those things tampered down in a really counterproductive way, but in an undeniable way.
I just got a text from someone in Seattle, and there's a couple of people in the Kraken organization that would like to point out that they're listening right now, a couple of old MVSW fans. So using that as a jump-off point, I think Seattle's hit a ton of right notes, like, all along the way. This thing's been a symphony so far, even to the game where they mounted, you know, an unlikely comeback against the Vegas Golden Knights the other night. You have some wide-brush thoughts on Seattle, who, as we know now, whether you talk to Bill Daly or Gary Bettman or Donald Fehr at the Players Association, both financially have become a really important league in the NHL, and culturally as well, how they do business. They've become already a leader in that space. Give us your roller painting thoughts on the Seattle Kraken.
First off, I'll take the over 91.5 points in the standings. For them, pretty easy call on that one. I think they win that game if they didn't come out with the jitters in the first period. I mean, I thought they really settled down and played well and showed enough. You know, if they're going to get their D activated as much as they did later in that game, and that might have the function of trying to get back in the game and scoring goals because they were trailing, but like, it was encouraging because the only thing that gives me pause about them is their ability to generate offense from their forward group. But I'll say this about the Kraken. We all fell in love with the home jersey pretty quickly. The road jersey outstrips the home jersey. The roadies, the whites, are some of the best sweaters in the league. And here's the thing. We already did the Aquafresh trope with the Islanders' fish sticks jersey. We're not bringing it back. I understand the Kraken look like toothpaste. I completely get it. But we already did that once. The joke's been made. You got to go and move on to something else.
Okay, hang on one second. There's only one thing I don't like about the white outfits, and that is the blue. The blue in it. You know when your printer is running out of ink?
Yeah.
Doesn't that resemble that blue?
Yeah, but what you're talking about is a color that doesn't exist in the NHL. You know, at one point that they were talking about being like a black and red team, and my heart sank.
What are we doing?
I was a sockeye guy. And I was a sockeye guy because at one point they were talking about making like a pinky, salmon-y color as part of their color scheme, which would have been really dope. I mean, listen, you and I both know they should be the Seattle Easter Eggs and had a cornucopia of different colors as their palette. It didn't work out that way. We were well ahead of the curve there. Either that or the Sasquatch.
No, that's the one.
The Sasquatch was pretty good, too. But they settled on a really cool mascot. And in turn, I mean, you stack it up against the rest of this league, and I defy you to find, outside of, you know, the vaulted original six or arbitrary six, in your words, a better road jersey than what the Kraken wear.
I prefer now, looking back on it with an older lens, the Solvent Six. How about that? the Solvent Six. Let's go that way.
I know. I liked Arbitrary better than that.
It felt
like you were railing against having been forced to accept these teams as
There was an NHL pre-World War II. Let's just understand this. Just go back to 1917 with a very famous backstabbing with Eddie Livingston and the rest of the NHL saying, yeah, you're left holding the bag here. We're going to go form our other league.
I'm sure people know that there was an NHL before World War II. They do listen to your show.
Thank you. Listen to my little act. One of the things that, you know, I used to love doing with you is rule changes. And the latest one that I'm on, I'm curious what yours is. The latest rule change that I keep stumping for involves the penalty kill, which I don't really see as a kill. It's not. It's very Canadian. See, Canadians have an ethic not of conquering, but enduring. We have a large geography. We have four distinct seasons. We don't have a very huge population. We endure the seasons. You know, we're spread out geographically. The penalty kill right now, as constructed in the NHL, is all about enduring. There is no killing the penalty at all. There is penalty endurance. There's no penalty kill. Here's my thought. If you score a shorthanded goal, penalty's over. The box opens. You score the goal, you point to the penalty box, it opens, and the player... That is a true penalty kill. That would put the kill in penalty kill. That's the one that I'm going to keep stumping until someone in the NHL finally says, will you just shut up? We're never going to change this. That would make it a legitimate... Just think of like how a crowd would react. Home team scores a shorthanded goal, spotlight on the penalty box as the door opens. We want to talk about creating momentum, creating excitement. I think that's one of the ways you can do it in an otherwise moment where you're just out there looking to block shots and ice the puck. Do you have a pet NHL rule you would like to see changed? Greg Wyshynski of ESPN.
Well, first of all, I think that your rule change idea is good, and I think it speaks to the moment because the power kill has become so in vogue in this league. You know, teams are now actively attempting to generate offense when they're on the penalty kill, and I think that kind of would even encourage it more and make it more exciting. So I endorse your rule change. It's one of your better ones.
Thank you.
Listen, you guys know the shootout sucks. It's always sucked. It is especially bad now, where we are now 16 years into it, and it is perfunctory and repetitive, and you can easily just change the channel. Although, don't change it from ESPN or Sportsnet, and not have to watch the end of the game. I will say again that I don't want to see a game end without a teammate on the ice or a pass attempted or anything that resembles the previous, you know, 65 minutes of hockey that you've been watching or whatever. So here's my thing.
Okay.
You end it with power plays. You end it let's call it 4-on-3. Send it on a 4-on-3 power play. The home team gets the advantage. You get a full – you can do a minute if you want, if you really wanted to spice it up. You get a minute to score if you score, game's over. sudden death power play to end the game instead of the shootout.
I do like, listen, the shootout has lost a lot of its luster. And I know it's meted with collective groans by many quarters. Here's the other thing, though, that I'll add to it. You know what else has lost a lot of its shine? 3-on-3.
What's
that? 3-on-3.
How dare you? How dare you?
I'll tell you why. I will tell you why. It is no longer, remember the, when the, of course you do, when 3-on-3 started, the best one I, by the way, the best 3-on-3 I've ever seen was in the first season. It was late in the season. It was at Ottawa, Detroit, and it was five solid minutes of just lead, of a just, you know, odd man rush, odd man rush, odd man rush, odd man back. And it was the craziest 5 minutes of hockey I've seen. Ottawa, Detroit was fantastic. But what it's become now is, because we're all waiting for the coaches to get their hooks into this thing, right? Oh, the great thing about 3-on-3 is it's uncoachable. That took a cozy, what, couple of seasons until the coaches got their hooks in. And now it's nobody wants to take a low percentage shot for fear of an odd man rush going the other way. Nobody wants to surrender the puck. So what do we get? We get slow play and we get endless neutral zone regroups, nonstop regroups. Now, Brian Burke always talks about putting a shot clock on for 3-on-3. And if it'll end this, you know, endless, mindless parade of neutral zone regroups, I might entertain it. But 3-on-3 is kind of getting Dullsville, isn't it? Like, there'll be a couple of moments where it's exciting for a scoring chance. But other than that, how many times can you watch teams regroup in the neutral zone, Wish?
First of all, never trust a man who wants to put ice hockey in the Summer Olympics. Second of all.
That's me, too.
Exactly. My point stands. Second of all, the 3-on-3 is coachable. I think we know that now. But you know what it's not? It's controllable. And that is the thing about the 3-on-3 that makes me want it to stick around. And I agree, like, the visceral thrill of it has subsided a little bit, although not on the steep curve of the shootout. Because you're all, even in the worst 3-on-3, even in the 3-on-3, you're just like, somebody please do something. Somebody will do something, and then it will fail. And then somebody comes back the other way in a 2-on-1.
Yeah,
and then that'll fail, and it always. I have never watched a 3-on-3 that didn't get to that point where somebody tries to make a move, it doesn't work out, and then all of a sudden the chaos switch gets flipped for at least another minute. It happens in every 3-on-3 I've ever seen, and as long as that's the case, as long as it's not just like, you know, a chess match where there's one shot attempt in the entirety of it, then I'm okay with it.
Okay, let me go one step further with this then. The idea that it's coachable but not controllable. For maximum chaos and maximum excitement, how about this one? After 60 minutes of play, the score is now tied at 2s. We head to the 3-on-3. Coaches, please leave the bench.
Great. Fantastic.
Just get rid of the coaches.
You're basically asking for what, Peter Laviolette to show up in the shadows of the hallway in a fake mustache like Bobby Valentine? Is that
Bobby Valentine, yeah.
Who are you, sir? Oh, I'm the equipment guy. I'm just out here to take a gander at the 3-on-3.
I'm Peter Raviolette. I don't know who this Laviolette fella is anyhow. Listen, this is a lot. I got to hustle. You know, what we have coming up on the other side is Katie Gay, who's going to be one of the 10, female officials in the American Hockey League,
this
season. Yeah, she'll, she's working the, Lehigh Valley, Wilkes-Barre, Scranton Penguins game on Saturday. Listen, I just want to get your thoughts on, you know, this. I don't want to say it's an idea because I think it was an inevitability that this was going to eventually there would be, you know, female lines people and female referees. I'm not surprised that we got there this quickly, although many might be. Are you surprised we got there this quickly? I know it's not NHL yet, but, you know, Kirsten Welsh is working in the OHL. There'll be 10 working the lines and the dots in the American Hockey League. I don't think it's surprising we got there now. Are you?
No, I don't think it's surprising because the NHL can blaze some trails. I mean, I can't help but look at Major League Baseball now trying to hold half its season outdoors and in different venues and cornfields and stuff. I think that's very much in keeping with what the NHL did with the Winter Classic. But the NHL is also a place where they're going to wait to see someone else do it first. I think that happened with advertising on uniforms. I think it's happened here where you see it happen in the NBA, you see it happen in the NFL, and then obviously the ball will keep rolling and then it happens in hockey as far as diversifying the officiating crews at the minor league level and eventually the NHL level. That's great. And you know, it's the tip of the iceberg for the amount of work that still needs to be done, especially in front offices, where I think that the NHL is really lagging behind the curve when it comes to getting people who don't look like me or you involved in front office capacities in this league. And that's really, for me, has always been the most important thing, because those are the people that are holding the gates and they're keeping the gates. And as long as you can change the gatekeepers in this league, then everybody gets lifted up. And I think this is a small incremental step toward the end.
Amen, brother. All right. Getting that soap and warm water feeling, being back on with you again, Wish. Hey, listen, quick plug for Puck Soup. Give it to them for people that don't know about
Heck
it.
Yeah. Me and Down Goes Brown and Ryan Lambert, Puck Soup. It's a little podcast born out of the ashes of MVSW. And still doing that weekly. Have a Patreon as well. But again, if you miss the show and the vibe, I got a column every Thursday, ran today, that has sort of the Puck Daddy-ish MVSW vibe. And then, we'll be popping in here and there doing stuff on this whole rights holder thing. I got to wear pants now and a tie occasionally. Ooh. It's such a pain, but apparently
scrub the soup off your tie now. Like, geez.
Well, it's, you know, in tribute to you and Sportsnet, I was photographed the other day wearing what someone referred to as diarrhea pants, which is
best trade deadline ever. You graded trades based on Milbury's. What was it? What was it again?
I had the Milbury scale that judged trades on like a four Milbury heads trade was a disaster for one team. But famously, Sportsnet, comedically, but also seriously, made me change my pants during the show because it looked like I was wearing diarrhea pants.
Yeah, Deb Berman, who is our national stylist, still very much with us and dressing everybody, including Elliot Friedman. And I always defer to her. That was a fun day. I remember getting a text from you that night, because I didn't go to the after party. I just went home, saying, Doug McClain wants to kill me.
Because we did a bit where we talked about which active general manager would end up in the fired GM's room on Sportsnet.
Right, yeah, and the strategy room. Yeah.
Yeah, Doug.
Which, by the way.
Yeah, you guys called it the strategy room. It was actually the fired GM's room, and Doug took it very personally.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I just found out who they created that room for, and surprise, surprise, it wasn't me. I was the plan B. I was the fallback plan. I was told they created that room for Bob McCowan. That was their idea to try to get Bob McCowan into the hockey group. That if they put him in a room with general managers and did power top, it was a great idea, right?
Yeah. And then I was wondering why you were wearing sunglasses that day. That all makes sense.
With the big feathers and the sunglasses. And no, that was originally supposed to be for McCowan. And he told him to go kick rocks. And then they went to plan B, which was me.
As Bob does.
Hey, I'm number two. All right. Thanks, Wish. We'll catch up soon, pal. You be good.
You got it, bud.
There he is, the great Greg Wyshynski from ESPN and the Puck Soup podcast. We're hitting pause here on the program. That was a lot of fun. Hope you enjoyed it. Hope to do it again, and maybe even often.